This is Mentor, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps. Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. So this week, we're talking all about stigma and stereotypes with writer and campaigner Lucy Nicol. This episode is a really important one to me, obviously hosting the podcast to destigmatize mental health. Stigma was something we'd have to give a whole episode to at some point. And so we'll just start off with a few stats from Time to Change on survey results they've found in some of the stigma people have around mental illness. They found that 1 in 20 people believe that those with mental health problems should not be allowed to have children. This one really personally offends me, as you'll know many of the guests that we've had on the show have children and are incredible parents. It's also, it doesn't quite even make sense in and of itself as a mentality, because many people who have postnatal depression, for example. So if a statement like that was true, then how can it make sense that they shouldn't be allowed to have children? Well, then what if they have a diagnosis afterwards? Does that mean the children get taken away? That doesn't seem in the best interest at all for so many children. These just make me mad, but I'm going to run through them quickly rather than ranting. 66% of people in Wales, according to a poll from YouGov, commissioned again by Time to Change, would not rent a room in a shared flat to someone with a mental health condition. The irony here is most people of that 66% probably have rented a place to someone with a mental health condition. Similarly, a different study found fewer than 4 in 10 employers would consider hiring a person with a mental health problem, compared to more than 6 in 10 who would hire a person with a physical disability. And that again highlights some of the disparity with how mental health is treated. And the last one I wanted to mention was a study from 2003 called Stigma and Depression Among Primary Care Patients. And one of the conclusions of this study was, although a number of health conditions lead to stigmatization, mental health problems are second only to HIV/AIDS in regards to discrimination and ostracization. So I'm really glad in this episode we get into dismantling a lot of examples, and we also do cover things mentioned there. And so, yeah, so that's just quickly running through those. We'll now get into the episode with Lucy Nicol in just a moment. I think you'll really love her insight. We'll get into that in just a moment, but first,
this week's Audible recommendation.
I'm recommending A Series of Unfortunate Stereotypes by this week's guest, Lucy Nicol. Tagline for the book is Naming and Shaming Mental Health Stigmas. To tell you about it far better than I would be able to, here is Lucy herself.
A Series of Unfortunate Stereotypes is my book about mental health stigma and stereotypes. It's quite funny, so I'm told. It's part memoir, and it's also a bit of a comment on media portrayals of mental illness over the years. So there's tons of pop culture and nostalgia and stuff in there as well. Hopefully very relatable, accessible, and a bit of a laugh.
And if you like the sound of that, you can, as always, get the book on Audible, and you can use our link bit.ly/mentalbooks if you want to try your first book with Audible for free.
My name's Lucy Nicol. I am a mental health campaigner, and my journey with mental illness, I guess, started when I was 15 years old, so way back in the 90s. And it was when I actually thought that I might have deep vein thrombosis, which resulted in a panic attack. I didn't know what it was at the time, and I called my mum, And it was my mum that actually pointed out to me that it was far more likely that I was having a panic attack than that I was suffering with DVT, which just to be something that was out in the media at the time. So that's kind of where it really started for me. And over the years, these panic attacks and my anxiety increased, decreased. It wasn't a straight line. But here I am today, understanding it a bit more and managing it the best that I can.
And so this episode, we're really working to focus on stereotypes and stigma. So in your book, I like the way you talked about your own internalized stigma that you realized in hindsight you had growing up. Do you mind sharing a few details about that?
Certainly, because I think things have moved on an awful lot. Certainly when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s, I think we're all pretty naive and ignorant. I say all, not everybody, but certainly in, you know, myself and my group of friends, we lived down the road from some supported accommodation. And it wasn't even a mental health service. It was a learning disability service. And I remember as kids, we used to talk about living near the nut house and daring each other to kind of, you know, do the knock and run and all of that stuff. I mean, it didn't help that this house was one of these great big old grand houses with like trees. It was a little bit spooky. But when I look back, I do think that, you know, some of the things that I was fed with through the media, through films like Fatal Attraction, and just the general talk and newspaper headlines, I certainly use stigma myself, if that's the right phrase. So I was certainly guilty of it. And I think it's interesting to acknowledge that and acknowledge that none of us are perfect.
Yes. And that's part of why I was so glad you did acknowledge that in your writing, because it's particularly once you've gone through mental illness yourself, it can be difficult to admit that by having some internalized stigma, you can be part of the problem. But I think it's really important to confront, because it's something that a little bit like other kinds of ignorance that people have to get over. There's a certain amount of name calling that goes on, but actually it's far more powerful to admit where you do have some ignorance and try and work on it than a lot of people seem to try and explain it away and be like, no, I'm accepting. I just don't want to live with them. I just don't want to be friends with them. But I'm accepting.
Yeah, I think there's, because I see quite a lot on social media. Obviously, there's a huge mental health community, especially I spend a lot of time on Twitter, too much time, to be honest. But I think, you know, if somebody says something like, oh, my God, I'm so OCD, I've cleaned my house like Monica or something like that. And I think you can see that actually that person is probably not trying to be malicious or cruel a lot of the time. It's a lack of understanding. And I think the best way to change and make an impact in that area is not by kind of attacking that person, but engaging them in a conversation. And I think, you know, if you attack that person, it's really not going to help. The conversation will shut off very quickly. Whereas if you have a conversation with them to try to understand why they think that and talk to them about what, you know, if it was OCD or if they were saying, oh, my God, I'm so depressed. I, you know, missed out on whatever piece of clothing in Topshop sale or something. Mm-hmm. You know, if you can actually engage in a conversation and discuss why that depiction of mental illness, of depression or OCD is wrong, then you're going to have a much more positive impact from that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny you should mention the OCD example. It's one we've mentioned quite a few times on the show. It's just like where they've reduced it down to something so narrow that doesn't actually really reflect the condition at all.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, saying, oh, I'm so depressed, what you would usually mean if you're not talking about the illness is, oh, I'm a bit sad or I'm a bit put out, which again, in terms of depression, does not, you know, I'm sure people with depression are quite sad but at times, but that's, you know, that's a tiny part of it. It's about energy. It's about and lethargy and all of those other things and feeling so hopeless. It's not about being sad because, you know, England are out the World Cup. It's a completely different thing. I think we do need to kind of talk more about it and understand that these illnesses are not just those tiny little bits that we tend to jump on, and that, you know, I'll be honest, that I've jumped on in the past. Absolutely, I have.
Yeah.
So I think we just need to learn, and we need to accept none of us are perfect. Let's not attack people. Let's just have a conversation about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. And so obviously yourself, you're involved in the media. You've done some great writing for loads of news publications. And so you're probably better to speak than I am on how these stereotypes are portrayed in the media as well. I found that particularly interesting in your writing.
So if we think about the traditional news media, I think there's been some big changes, but I think there's still quite a lot to do. I mean, the very fact that Natasha Devon started the Mental Health Charter, which journalists and writers sign up to commit to responsible mental health reporting and writing, shows that there is still quite a lot to do. I mean, I think Happy Pills was talked about in The Sun only, you know, a matter of months ago.
Yeah.
But what is interesting is that you do see publications like The Sun and others that, you know, there are journalists that work there who are starting to do a little bit more work, who are starting to engage with campaigns like Time to Change. So I think it's quite refreshing to see that there has been a step change, but it certainly isn't perfect. There's still a huge amount of work to do. You know, nobody who takes antidepressants wants to be thought of as popping happy pills, because it could not be further from the truth. So the impact that that kind of headline can have is absolutely, it can be devastating for some people. It can stop people seeking help, stop people, you know, taking their medication. So the impact is more than a little bit of, oh, that's upset me. It can have a huge impact on somebody's recovery journey. So, you know, I think the news media, we consume it all around us, and we consume it obviously not just in the newspaper, it's all over social media. It's kind of coming at us from all directions. I think that is one of the biggest sources. But it does obviously go beyond that. And, you know, when you think about mental health portrayals in TV, soaps, dramas, in the movies, and even right down to social media accounts, influencers on social media, you know, you can see big conversations being started when Piers Morgan said of Will Young that he had whiny, needy twerp syndrome.
Yes.
You know, so even just an individual on social media can have such a big negative impact. So yeah, it's all around us, it's everywhere.
Yeah, and I think not just for mental health conversations, but in general, I think anyone that has a platform does have a certain responsibility, because people can really hide behind the distance of the internet. But ultimately, as you've highlighted there, the things people say can stop people taking their medication, can potentially get people to maybe not consider suicide in the first place, but reconsider it if it's something they're going through. And that's quite scary. And so I'm glad to see with like campaigns like Natasha Devon's that you've mentioned there, that we are getting further forward with that. You also mentioned in your book how people like Amy Winehouse were portrayed, and she's a particular sore spot of mine.
Yeah, she, I mean, it's interesting you brought that up today, because it's the anniversary of her death today.
Yeah.
And I just think it's absolutely terrible. It's another kind of dimension altogether, actually, because there's something around how people in the media are portrayed and the media portrayals there, but also how people who are in the media, who have an artistic role, I think there's more than just how they are portrayed. It's also kind of that, you know, that they must keep going on. And I think if people watch the Amy documentary, and there was a little bit in that really upset me about how when she was I think she'd had a lot to drink or something, and she passed out or something, and how she was put into a taxi to get onto a flight.
Yes.
And carry on. For us, for, you know, for the audience, for people to enjoy her entertainment, but the person gets lost behind the brand, or, you know, the sort of the celebrity, and So it's not just kind of how the media portrays mental illness or how the media portrays stars who are struggling with mental illness, but what that kind of profile does to that person. They become a business of overall, you know, over them being a person who might need help.
Yeah, they almost become a brand. And then that's in many ways how the traps of social media can go right up to the most known or the most popular, because in the same way, you know, friends we'll know personally will be posting like their best photos. They may have taken 40 photos to get that one that goes on social media. Well, the pop stars are all doing that too, except they have, you know, awesome photographers and everything else. And so it can become easily so separate who they really are as a person and this social media person they create.
Yeah, definitely. There's obviously the person that they create and the act or the artist that they want to put out to the world. But then there's also on the other side, I suppose, if somebody is struggling and they're going to get papped by the press, then that side is exposed to the world as well. And that's not always helpful for people in recovery. You know, certainly if I was having a panic attack in the street, I wouldn't want that all over the front of the tabloids. Whereas somebody like Amy Winehouse, you know, sadly, we saw all of her darkest days because the media picked up on it, which obviously can't have been helpful for her. And I think which also very sadly probably took away some of the support from the public, you know, because it's not a pretty picture. So, you know, I just think that's incredibly sad that those moments that shouldn't be out there for the general public are put out there and then have even more of a detrimental impact on the person who's suffering.
Yeah, I agree with all of that, really. And so in terms of then stereotypes, we dug around in our research for some particularly common ones that are hopefully broad enough to encompass a range of mental illnesses. So I've just got something to read out about each of them, and then I'd love to hear your thoughts. How does that sound?
Yeah, that's great.
Okay, so one of the stereotypes was people with mental illness are dangerous and unpredictable.
Oh, yes. I think that's one of the most harmful ones, isn't it?
And unfortunately, it seems one of the most prevalent as well.
It is. I think that's absolutely devastating when people with mental illness are more likely to be more vulnerable than dangerous in the majority of cases. And I did some work with a group of people who live with severe and enduring mental illness, talking about people who live in supported accommodation. And I think a lot of the diagnoses were personality disorder or schizophrenia, that type of illness that might produce sort of psychotic symptoms. And I did some work on stigma with them because I knew that when that particular service was opening up, the community were very, very frightened about it. And this, again, harks back to the whole, you know, people with mental illness are dangerous. And, you know, I spent the day with this wonderful group of people and who'd all been through so many struggles and who were doing everything they could and being really strong, getting their lives back on track. And they said the thing that upset them the most was when people would assume that because they had this diagnosis that they were dangerous. And we were actually talking about, and this is where the media steps in to do a really good job, we're actually talking about a portrayal of postpartum psychosis in EastEnders. And the whole group agreed. They said that when they watched that, they felt less alone and they felt, I think one of the guys said he felt relieved. Because they were portraying somebody, a character who, you know, for soap fans, a character who we'd grown to love and grown to know as a person who then endured postpartum psychosis. And so it was allowing the public to see beyond the illness because we already knew the person. And I think that's really important. I think that is an absolutely devastating stereotype because, you know, the people that it most often refers to are probably the most vulnerable people in society.
Yeah, exactly. I love that you brought up portrayal of people in soaps there, because I agree that's that's one of the examples where it's generally done well. Whereas in other types of programming that's more short form, like they have series rather than just continuously running, often a character is brought in who has some mental illness, and that's then the thing that defines their kind of character arc and who they are. And I think it's long time we move beyond that.
Yeah, I think there's, I mean, I do think there's been some really good ones. I work as a freelancer with Mind Script Advisory Team, the researchers for various programs, and not just for soaps, you know, for dramas. And I think we've had stuff through of like short films and stuff as well. They work closely with Mind's Script Advice Team to look at scripts, to look at portrayals for a couple of things. First of all, is it accurate? And secondly, you know, what kind of impact could this have?
Yes.
So, you know, it may be that, for example, you might have a good friend who, you know, makes a joke about your mental illness because that's the kind of relationship you have. And so that can happen, and that is fine. And that is how some people might, you know, manage their conversations about it. It could be helpful for some people. However, if you put that out to a broader audience, that could have a detrimental impact, because if somebody thought, right, that's the way I need to talk about it, and that relationship and that understanding wasn't there, that could have a negative impact. So it's really, I just think it's fantastic that certainly all the big soaps are working with Mind to ensure really responsible portrayals. And obviously you've got to balance art and drama and, you know, the storyline. So, you know, it's never 100%. Well, it can be, but sometimes it's not 100%. But they are making real efforts to ensure responsible portrayals today, which is fabulous. And I think that not only does that not have a negative impact, it actually has a positive impact, because when there's been certain portrayals of storylines, it's found that more people have sought help from various helplines on the topic who may have otherwise been too frightened to speak out about what they were going through. So whilst I am a big EastEnders fan, and people can laugh at me for putting my feet up and watching the soaps too much, but I do actually think there's a really sort of a social responsibility and an educational side to what the soaps do.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that's great. It's great to hear you're a part of that. Just to summarise some of the research we did on it, most people with mental illness never commit acts of violence or crime, and are far more likely to be victims of crime or violence. I used to work for West Midlands Police, and that's absolutely something I saw reflected in my day-to-day work there as well. I've got a stat for that. According to data from the National Epidemiologic Survey on alcohol and related conditions, they found only 3% of people with mental illness are violent. And I imagine even within that 3%, there's often things that are, you know, motivating it, that's going on in their personal lives as well. So that's not like 3% of them are going to lash out at a stranger even.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you think about it, people who experience mental illness are 1 in 4. You know, certainly know that 1/4 of the population are not violent. I think the stigma does attach itself more to some of the more sort of severe and enduring mental illnesses and diagnoses like personality disorder, because whilst I'm not an expert, I think that when you look at that sort of range, they're absolutely so extreme, because it goes from, you know, borderline personality disorder. Well, we're talking about people who are suffering extreme distress, who are categorized in that area, in a category, if you like, personality disorders that you're going to put psychopathy in, you know. And they couldn't be further apart, because somebody with BPD is likely to experience too much emotion. So I think it's really sad that, and I think that just shows that we need to talk more about, you know, whilst I'm here and I have a diagnosis of generalized anxiety disorder, I think the public do feel more comfortable with anxiety and depression in a way, and kind of understanding what that is. And I think we need to talk more openly about some of the other experiences that people have, because there are certainly some illnesses that are more stigmatized than others.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think even people that know very little about mental illness, as you've described with those two conditions, anxiety and depression, people have a vague understanding, even if they don't have it right. Whereas some other conditions, which are still quite common, like bipolar, people can have a completely twisted idea of that. It wasn't so long ago I read a Mind proposal to government about NHS reform, and I can't remember the statistic, but they had a statistic for how many people thought bipolar meant split personality.
Yeah.
And I just wouldn't even imagine anyone thought that, but it was quite a scary high percentage.
Yeah, I think there's two extremes with stigma when you think about it. When you think about something like anxiety and depression, the biggest problems we face in terms of stigma are people being dismissive of it. Mm-hmm. Whereas then there are other illnesses like, say, schizophrenia, where people assume that person must be scary or dangerous or, you know, or weird. Both are forms of stigma. So it's really about understanding and talking more about it.
Okay, so we'll move on to the next common stereotype. People with mental illness are incompetent.
Right, yeah. So with mental illness, you have periods where you're not very well, mm-hmm. and you might not be able to function as well, and you have periods when you are well. And it's exactly the same as if you had food poisoning. If you had food poisoning, you would have a period of time where you couldn't go into the office. It's the same thing. I'm not comparing the illnesses, but I suppose what I'm saying is it's an illness in that you can recover from it. You are not. I mean, some people do suffer with much, much more severe forms of mental illness, which, you know, can have more of an impact on their life. But, you know, even people who live in supported accommodation because they need that 24/7 support, it doesn't mean that they can't do their own shopping or cook their own meals or, you know, go to the gym or do a college course or get a job. So I do think that it's a terrible stereotype. There are times in everybody's lives when they can't go to work or where, you know, they feel like they can't do as good a job because they are suffering with something, whether it be that they've, you know, got a stomach bug or a cold or, you know, having something like diabetes that they have to live with and manage. With mental illness, I think in the majority of cases, if people are given the right support and manage it, you know, you might not even know. Somebody, mm-hmm. you know, somebody might have a mental illness and you just wouldn't know because they're managing it so well and they can do just as good a job as anybody else.
And I definitely echo that in my experience as well. My first diagnosis was depression. And I find that depending how I'm doing with that now defines to a certain extent how people respond to it. So if I'm doing well and I'm not, you know, I'm managing it well, then people are far more likely to try and deny that I have it. Yeah. Whereas if I'm struggling, the response is very different. But really, both sides, whether you're doing well or whether you're not, are all a reflection of the illness. So it's very odd that you really have an easy fix for that. But I guess people feeling more open about talking about it, the fact that I, you know, now do this podcast, people are less likely to sort of challenge something that ultimately a doctor has diagnosed, and therefore they're not really qualified to challenge in the first place.
Yeah. I think we do too much of that, and I've certainly done too much of that in the past. I put my hands up to it. For some reason we associate mental illness with personality and mm-hmm. Like you say, competence, and we don't with physical illness. But it isn't part of a personality. It's an illness that you have good and bad days with, just like you do with, you know, a bad back or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. Because that's the truth of it. For many conditions, friends or acquaintances or whoever it is you speak to that may not understand what you're going through, often when you're at your worst, you're not seeing people anyway. I know that's certainly true for me. I kind of go a bit ghost mode with people. And so there aren't that many people that do see me at my worst.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think that also, you know, having a mental illness might mean that somebody is more vulnerable. Like, mm-hmm. certainly for me, with anxiety, I can, I pick up on a lot of things. I kind of imagine the worst quite a lot. Yes. And I think, you know, in the workplace, being able to talk about that and having people who understand how to respond to that when that happens, but not make a big deal of it. It's just the same as somebody who might need a standing desk because they've got a bad back. It's just, you know, if there are things that we need to be aware of kind of going forward, it's just how we accommodate that and how we relate to one another.
Yeah, absolutely. And so to bring in some of our research on that, to finish up that one, obviously that stereotype couldn't be further from the truth. In fact, there's people such as Abraham Lincoln, Winston Churchill, Ernest Hemingway, to name three, who are all brilliant, intelligent people, and yet diagnosed with mental illness at some point in their life. And to go even further to that, you need only visit our Instagram page, where we're constantly putting up quotes of people that you will have heard of who have gone through or are going through mental illness, and they're not going to be people you think of as incompetent, hence why you've heard of them in the first place.
Yeah, exactly.
And so the next stereotype, this one, I don't know if this is such, maybe it is still a stereotype, but to a lesser extent to the other ones. For me, this is more kind of pure ignorance, and that's people with mental illness are to blame for their conditions.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so there's a couple of things to look at here, I suppose, because first of all, when you've got something, I think when we look at the more common forms of mental illness, so for example, depression or anxiety, you hear the, oh, snap out of it, pull yourself together, what on earth have you got to be anxious about? And I think that's the lack of understanding around the fact that it is an illness, not just something that you've chosen to do. It's not about wallowing, or it's not about just being a nervous person. It's a completely different thing. So I think there's that, but I think I think with that conversation, it's about sort of striking a balance as well, because certainly nobody is to blame for mental illness. But I think there's also a thing around empowering people to look at what they can do to support their recovery journey as well. So I think that's, let's not forget that for somebody who is suffering with depression or anxiety or any form of mental illness, you know, so saying to someone, oh, go for a walk, you'll feel better, when somebody's been confined to their bed, yeah, if they could get out for a walk, they might feel better about themselves for doing it, but that is a very, very difficult thing to do. So I think there's something about supporting people and empowering people to do a little bit step by step to support them in their recovery. But absolutely, it is never anybody's fault that they have a mental illness. It's a horrible, like you say, very ignorant thing to suggest.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad to see that one is really on the decline. But unfortunately, I still do hear it said, and people can even sort of imply it, not realising how damaging that can be for people to hear. Because particularly so many conditions like anxiety, I'm sure you'll be able to relate to, there can be so much self-blame going on anyway. So you saying something like this is sort of unnecessary, because the person's already thought of it themselves many times, and you may just be confirming some toxic thoughts they've got going on anyway.
That is absolutely spot on. I've heard other people say that, you know, it doesn't help one little bit. And I think that, like I was saying as well, when you consider that, you know, by saying to someone, oh, go for a walk, go for a run, that is really not very helpful if somebody does feel frightened or does feel confined to their bed, or, you know, has got absolutely no energy or self-worth at the time. So it's being able to kind of support someone to do these things step by step, and just be there for them, to help them take those steps. I know that when I've had a panic attack, I know it's not my fault, because I've woken up at 3 a.m. and had a panic attack. I actually, just as I was nodding off last night, started to get panicky, and I had to go and sleep in the spare room just so I could, like, have some light on and, you know, play with my iPhone or read a book to distract me. It's certainly not my fault. And, you know, waking up in the middle of the night, you know, there's certainly nothing that I've done there that has encouraged that panic attack to happen. But then there's also certain things that I know that I can do to sort of try, not so much prevent it, but to minimize the impact of panic attacks and anxiety going forward. And I'll tell you one that I'm absolutely terrible with is caffeine. I drink far too much caffeine. But I think it's just, as I was saying, there's that sort of balance of kind of, it's not our fault, but we also shouldn't feel helpless. We should feel that there are things that we can do, and there are opportunities, hopefully, not for everybody, because we know how much the NHS is stretched, but that there are opportunities and ways that we can overcome it. But nobody's asked for it.
Absolutely. And also, I'd just add on to that that it's not only that it's not the person's fault who's going through it, but also it can be completely different things that have caused it. You know, it can be things like childhood trauma, like life experiences they've gone through, to a certain extent biology, depending on the condition. So there's so many other things that are at play here. It's not self-imposed. Before saying something like that, you've got to ask yourself, who would really wish one of these conditions on themselves?
Because there's this whole thing of attention seeking as well. And I think that's where self-stigma comes in as well, because certainly when I started blogging, I started thinking I was going to look like an attention seeker. And, you know, I'm sure there are some Facebook friends who probably thought I was. But actually, overall, it was cathartic for me, and it did help other people. I do think that's how you kind of internalize stigma. That's the kind of, it can make you feel much, much worse. It can make your recovery much, much slower if you start to internalize thoughts like that.
Grand. All right. So we are unfortunately running low on time now. So we'll just finish up by talking a little bit about your book. And that covers, you know, a lot of the things we've talked about today. That's why you were really the perfect guest to tackle something like stigma and stereotypes with. So do you want to tell us a bit about that book?
So, yeah, the book is a series of unfortunate stereotypes. So no prizes for guessing what inspired that title. Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, I'll tell you the story behind what inspired that title. It was the first time I was writing about mental illness outside of my blog, and it was for Sarah Millican's magazine. And I started writing about the stereotypes around anxiety, and the stereotypical image that came into my head was that of Aunt Josephine from a series of unfortunate events. Oh, yeah. And she's this very, very nervous woman who's terrified of, like, everything. And I just thought that I totally can't relate to that. I'm scared of spiders, but, you know, I don't come across as a really nervous, weak, timid person. And so that, to me, was kind of it's where the title came from, a series of unfortunate stereotypes, because of that link. But I think that it all kind of came about because I started writing and started blogging and, you know, was writing about my experiences. And then I realised, which is probably because I did so much work in PR and in the media, that I was fascinated by media representations and that media representations had kind of influenced me over the years growing up and my thinking around mental health and mental illness. And kind of also looking at my experience of having an anxiety disorder. But I also did some work with Time to Change, and their campaign really stood out to me because I just felt that as somebody who had a panic attack at 15 and really didn't speak to her friends about anxiety until she was 21, 22, I thought that it could make such a huge difference if people were able to speak out. And even in this day and age, it's much, much, much better than when I was young, but still not perfect. So the book is a series of these stereotypes and my feelings on them, not as a professional. I am not a mental health professional. I have lived experience, I've experienced stigma, and I've soaked in all of these media portrayals. So I've, you know, commented on feeling, I know people have called me aloof before because I used to be so socially anxious. I used to just close people off, shut people off. But it would come across as being, you know, a bit up myself or a bit aloof. And a lot of people with anxiety get that. I've heard a lot of people talk about that. Narcissism as well, back to that whole attention-seeking thing. I remember the first time I went to a Time to Change event, one of the participants said, do you not worry that people will think you're quite narcissistic, writing about yourself a lot? And so I think that's something that chimes with a lot of people who talk about, who speak out about mental illness. But then there are other things you look at, like the pill popper I've talked about. You know, we've seen that on the front page of The Sun, really unhelpful. Actually, you know, I take an antidepressants for the last 3 or 4 years, but they're not happy pills. They don't get me high. I don't start dancing around the kitchen just because I've taken my daily dose. They help to sort of even things out, and they're part of a more holistic picture. So the book kind of goes through a lot of the things that I've either experienced in terms of stigma and stereotypes or that have been fed to me through the media and society.
Great. So definitely I would recommend people taking a look at that. I really enjoyed it myself. I was happy you mentioned Caitlin Moran in it, because I literally was, I listened to it as audio. And I just thought that's who you really remind me of in your writing style.
So... Oh, that is the biggest compliment I've ever had. I'm totally a Caitlin Moran fangirl. Like, I'm constantly Twitter stalking.
Me too.
So, yeah, that's just absolutely made my year.
All right, well, I might have to leave a review.
Love it.
So if anyone else listening likes Caitlin Moran, here you go. Here's someone else you might like. Grand. So I'd love to talk to you more, but sadly we are running out of time. So thank you so much for being part of the show. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.